It's my great pleasure to introduce Professor Silvana Sciarra, who is now a member of the Italian Constitutional Court, but was here for a year back in the 2000s as a Goodhart professor and made a very significant contribution both to European law and to labour law in the faculty. So it's a great pleasure to welcome you back. She has been for many years a professor of labour law at the University of Florence. You know, because of her court duties, she now no longer is directly connected with the university, but she's very much a scholar turned judge, and therefore is going to give us an insight into the way in which the Constitution of Italy has managed to survive 70 years now, and the role the court has played in that particular survival. So with great pleasure, can I introduce Professor Silvana Sciarra?
Thank you so much. Thank you. It is really quite emotional to be back in Cambridge and to see old friends. So thank you for the invitation, which is a great joy for me. Yes, I'm talking about this anniversary of the Constitution, which was actually last year, 70 years old last year. And it has been a step forward for the Constitutional Court, as if the Constitutional Court started rejuvenating itself because of the celebrations. And we were discussing before, John, about this new attempt the Italian court makes to communicate better with the external world through a journalist, through press releases, translations into English of some decisions, which are not easy to find on the website, but they're there. And also, because of the anniversary, judges went to schools and to prisons to meet young people and people deprived of their freedom, to bring the Constitution to them and to make the court works more transparent. I found this experience fascinating and highly engaging as a person, I must say particularly visiting prisons, which I'm going to do again in February in Florence, in this prison in Florence, where questions are put to the judges and the discussion on the 70 years constitution is open, and of course lots of interesting insights come through. I think it's important to point that this transparency issue, this opening up of the court, has to do with trust for the court and for the constitution. I think it's a particularly difficult time in countries throughout Europe. It is a difficult time in Italy. So there is an attempt to make sure that people understand the institutional role of the court and therefore learn more about the Constitution. The anniversary, 1948 Constitution, last year, coincided with another anniversary, because in 1938, the racist legislation was passed in Italy, and all sorts of measures were adopted, reducing Jewish people's freedoms, access to commerce and to professions and whatever. And there was a significant ruling of the court of the Constitutional Court years later in 1998. Affirming very clearly that a generalized and systematic persecution of rights became, in that case, a persecution of Jewish people's life. This is just to say that we made a point of combining the two anniversaries together and bringing to the schools and possibly to prisons as well the message of the Constitution against this dreadful racist legislation. And there is a principle of equality there, which governs so many, Article 3 of the Constitution, which governs so many cases, race is one of the grounds on which discrimination is forbidden. And there was a discussion because of racist attacks in Italy during the last few years, whether race should be deleted from the Constitution, from Article 3. And a former president of the Constitutional Court, well-known legal historian Paolo Grossi, might be known to some of you, he made a point of saying, no, 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 we should keep race, although there is no philological deep knowledge of this word, neither there is a genetics description of what race should be. It's a wrong word, but it should stay there until racism occurs in Italy. So there is no discussion now of changing Article 3 and deleting the word race. I think some, a little bit of history, a little bit of an historical approach maybe is a good point to clarify why the Italian Constitution, 70 years after its enactment, still portrays very well the characteristics of a pluralist society and a struggling population. Italy, the Italians are still a struggling population. They were struggling after war, poverty and regional divisions. They were struggling to reduce inequality, to enhance dignity as a value, and dignity is a recurring concept throughout the Italian Constitution. They were struggling to bring together different cultures and even different ideologies, and they were meant to come together in this melting pot, which is the Italian Constitution. I'm sure some of you have heard the name of Togliatti, who was, Palmiro Togliatti, was a leading figure of the then Communist Party, and a member of the assembly who wrote the Constitution. And Togliatti was reluctant to use the word compromise, which is often used to describe how so many different cultures came together in the Italian Constitution, the Catholic, the socialist, communist, and the so-called liberal cultures. He was not very happy with this word compromise, although there was a compromise there, and because he said this is the final outcome of a text conceived by men and women coming from different backgrounds, and we have to search unity to make the Constitution for the whole of nations. So there's no reason to use the word compromise, because this is just a common effort. And it is worth recalling this language of reconciliation, which was so common to the different cultures, the different people who were together in the assembly writing the Constitution. A word of reconciliations, which we find so difficult sometimes nowadays to hear in politics. And again, Italy is facing problems of poverty and working poor, and we are fearing the accentuation of divisions between the north and the south, northern and southern regions. Some regions, and this is one of the points of possible changes in the next few years, some regions are claiming more autonomy on legislative competences. We have state competence and regional competence on legislation. They are claiming, some regions of the north, in particular Lombardia and Veneto, claiming for more autonomy. This may create some tension, because there is a principle in the Constitution on the unity of the state as such. Let me mention also the emphasis that the Italian Constitution has on social issues, which are, of course, very close to my heart and to my work as a professor of labor law in the past. Because Article 1 is a peculiarity, I think, but you will tell me if I'm wrong, in a comparative perspective, because Article 1 talks of Italy as a democratic republic founded on labor, So the principle of democracy and sovereignty is connected to this expression, founded on labor. And a famous constitutional lawyer, who again was a member of the assembly writing the Constitution, Costantino Mortati, he wrote and explained many times that there was a careful choice of the word labor instead of workers, because workers implied in those days the notion of a class, the working class. And there should be no implication of a class dominating another class. So labor is, a clearer message. So sovereignty and labor. And then Article 4, again, very interesting, because Article 4 discusses the right to work, and it's a right to choose freely one's occupation. It's a very modern message, if one believes, as we all believe, in what now are described as active employment policies, and putting people, especially young people, those who have never had access to the labor market, to choose one's occupation, freely choose following inclinations and having training throughout their lives. This is the right to work, to choose freely and to contribute, this is the wording of Article 4, to the material or spiritual progress of society. It's a language which seems a little old-fashioned, but I like it very much, maybe because the age is similar, so it's perhaps my language. But Article 4 is one of those norms that you say it's a program, it's not a directly binding norm, although the court has interpreted it in binding terms. It's a program. It brings back this discussion on rights and principles, which we know so well in the Charter of Fundamental Rights of the European Union. The reason why it has a binding value is because the Constitutional Court interpreted the right to work together with another article of the Constitution, which is Article 35, in view of establishing essential guarantees for workers. So the right to work means, for example, that there should be legislation on unfair dismissals, although there is no guarantee to a stable occupation, but there should be fair working conditions and possibly legislation on fair dismissals. I was actually the drafter of a recent decision on dismissals law, and so I went back to a very interesting ruling of the court, a 1965 ruling, in which the right to work was connected to essential freedom of the human being. It did not give rise, as I mentioned before, to a stable occupation, but it was such a strong message to the legislator that the year after, 1966, there was the first coherent piece of legislation on unjust dismissals in Italy. So this is one of the examples in which the message sent through a ruling by the Constitutional Court has a follow-up in legislation. It doesn't always happen. In fact, many times when the court sends messages, warnings, even strong warnings, to the legislator may very well not pick up the suggestion to proceed. But in this case, we had legislation. And the reason why the combination of Article 4 and 35 was useful to me also in drafting this case, which was rather controversial because it had to do with a diminished protection for workers in dismissals law, is because Article 35 promotes the adoption of international agreements for the protection of workers. So in a sense, we could link up the right to work in the national constitutional law accession, and then international organizations, for example, the ILO Convention, the Charter of Fundamental Rights, and the European Social Charter. And this is an interesting point, because there is a reluctance of the court to open up to international sources. Something interesting. We may want to discuss this in detail later, if you like. But eventually, in 2018, in a decision on freedom of association for military people, and then in this decision I drafted on dismissals, the European Social Charter, the Council of Europe's European Social Charter, was eventually admitted to what the court calls an intermediate parameter, which means you cannot enforce the international source directly. You cannot do that. But you can call it inside the system through another article of the Constitution, which sends back to the international source, but you can actually read it and consider it, and if necessary, use it as a help in interpreting the challenge law which is before the court. So this is a cultural point that I think I've not yet come to terms with. Why are international sources so worrying for some of my colleagues? But we're getting there, because the European Social Charter is now a parameter. There is great attention on how to recall the European Convention on Human Rights, and great attention in adopting European legislation should be within the field of European law. So there's a very strict interpretation on this. Why is right to work also very interesting? It's interesting because in this Article 4, we discuss rights and duties. And so this has been at the center of many recent discussions because, for example, are we doing the right thing when we protect pensioners' rights? Are we doing the right thing for younger generations? There is a discussion on should the court take care of the future generations? Whose responsibility is to take care of future generations? And this is true also for environmental issues. Whose responsibility? Whose duties? Of course, the duties of older generations should be, in my view, compared or considered by Parliament rather than by a constitutional court. But sometimes there is a tension in some decisions. Should we proceed in continuing to protect vested rights, or should we open up? But then there is no guarantee that some of these decisions will necessarily open up, for example, new positions or new jobs for the future generation. But this is an issue which is highly controversial, and I think will come up again in the near future. I thought I would mention to you a few metaphors which have been used recently by scholars, mainly constitutional lawyers, writing little books on how to make sure that the Constitution is known and is this knowledge and this expertise is spread as much as possible. These are interesting metaphors because one of them discusses the title is "The Constitution Belongs to Everyone." La Costituzione è di tutti. Born to unite, nata per unire. And the final, very challenging, a textbook for living together convivenza. And the author is a former constitutional judge and professor of criminal law, Professor Flick. He mentioned to me he wanted to actually write a textbook for surviving, but that perhaps was a bit too much. But he does say this in the preface. So he's discussing convivenza, but in fact, he's discussing surviving. It's skeptical. It's a bitter title. On the other hand, there is an example. It's an example of spreading the old traditional values underpinning the Constitution and proving that they're still valid and they're still there to be recalled in modern discussions. And so longevity, 70 years old, but longevity implies health and determination. And somebody has mentioned that the Constitutional Court is the breathing lung of the Constitution. Again, all these metaphors bring back to a living body, which is nice. I mean, I like sort of concrete metaphors. This longevity of the Italian Constitution, despite some pretty harsh criticism that has been raised in the last few years, there was an attempt also to promote a referendum to introduce drastic changes to the Constitution, but it didn't go through a couple of years ago. So there's been criticism. But why some of the reasons of this longevity? The Italian Constitution is described as a rigid constitution, which means that no changes can be made to it through ordinary law. This is Article 138 of the Constitution. And this choice perhaps took into account in 1948 and in fact during the drafting of the constitution, fears of possible inclinations to revert to an oppressive and fascist regimes. So as if there was a fear of backwards looking approach. But on the contrary, I think it proved to be a forward-looking approach, an intelligent choice, because being a rigid constitution meant that it provoked the consolidation of the whole constitutional structure, solid enough to resist to changing parliamentary majorities. So there we have a counterbalancing power to the parliamentary majority. It's an institution guaranteeing the right balance. But a rigid constitution can very well become, and this is the case of the Italian constitution, a flexible one, in as much as it opens up to new rights. And this was done mainly through the case law of the Constitutional Court. However, the closing article, Article 139 of the Constitution, mentions very clearly that the status of the Republic may not be subject to constitutional amendment. So we cannot go back to a different setup of the institutions. Apart from this very clear final statement, there's been a long discussion, and this is due mainly to scholarship, but also to the case law of the Constitutional Court, on the so-called supreme principles of the Italian Constitution, principles which should not be attacked through legislation. They should stay as they are, they should not be changed. The first 12 articles, fundamental principles, the basic fundamental freedoms. But generally speaking, the overall architecture of the relationship among government, parliament, and the other institutions, constitutional institutions. There's been a case that perhaps some of you have heard of, a very famous Court of Justice case, the Taricco case, in which the Italian Constitutional Court recalled the substantive legality in criminal law as a supreme principle. Substantive legality, which is in Article 25, is a supreme principle and cannot be changed so easily and cannot be interpreted by the Court of Justice. There was a very interesting conversation going on there. And legal certainty is another supreme principle of the Constitution. So as you can see, it's rigid, it's flexible. I shall say in a minute how flexible it can be. But there are some basic points which the Constitutional Court tries very carefully to protect from legislative intervention and changes. So in my view, rigid is not a bad word. I mean, rigid may mean solid. Flexible, what does it mean? It means that there are very different interpretations of constitutional principles and rights. They may adjust over time. This is interesting. They change over time. They capture changing occurring in social and political life. And let me give you just a couple of examples. First of all, let me just mention that although this is a rigid constitution, in fact, there have been quite a few changes made to it. And some legislation came through rather late. For example, only in 1970, there was legislation to enact the state region competences. So rather late, the concrete implementation of measures for the functioning of the regions. In 2001, another very important reform of the state region competences. And then, not too long ago, a reform of Article 81 on state budget and the balance between revenue and expenditure, which was due to the fiscal compact. It was not necessary to adopt a constitutional amendment, but Italy chose to do so. So, in fact, the rigid constitution has been changed quite a bit, modified many times. but not change the original structure, which is part two on the organization of the Republic, and parliament with two houses. As I mentioned, the referendum trying to abolish one of the houses didn't go through. The president of the Republic, a figure of guarantee, guarantor of democratic balance between parliament and government, and so on. So, I think the first sign that the Constitution can be interpreted, as I mentioned before, with a forward-looking approach comes from the very first ruling of the Constitutional Court. It's ruling number one of 1956, because the Court only started to operate in 1956. There was some tension to approve the functioning of the Court. They wanted to wait a few years after the Constitution was enacted. In that case, the court had to scrutinize fascist legislation that had not been repealed, and we were in the field of free speech, so public order, free speech, and the court ruled its competence, declared to be competent to judge, to declare unconstitutional legislation which preceded the entering into force of the Constitution. And why did that? Because there was a prevailing point that dominated this argument, legal argument, eliminate measures which were contrary to a democratic regime. So a democratic regime could not coexist together with some remains of the past fascist regime. And the Constitution, in this case, many commentators say, proved to be much more advanced than the pre-existing legal system. The legal system was not able to reform itself quickly, but the court, with a forward-looking approach, was able to intervene. So the court, in this case, is really a driving force, is a force of changes, a force of innovation. I think the area in which we can detect and perhaps appreciate this slow but yet very persistent opening up of the constitutional of the constitution to changing values is family law. Perhaps the area in which a Catholic culture has been most felt and most influential. And I'll give you some examples of leading decisions which are often quoted to show how the flexibility comes through the Constitutional Court adjustment to new social values. In 1961, the court ruled constitutional, the different treatment between men and women in sanctioning adultery, which was a criminal offense. And they said, well, a woman's offense is worse than a man's offense, should be treated well, because there is a special family role for the woman. But in 1968, great year, those of us who have been around can remember, in 1968, the court changed its mind and said, well, it's time to re-examine this matter, and had to acknowledge the question had to be reconsidered. Equality between husband and wife in treating adultery must be equal. And so it ruled unconstitutional the law in question. What does this mean? Probably not much, except there is this mention of different social climate, of changing habits. So the references there are very subtle and also very cautious, but certainly the court did overrule the precedent of 1961. And in 2014, a very interesting case, the court ruled unconstitutional an automatic annulment of marriage in case of change of sex of one of the partners. Why did the court say this? Because the argument, and it's very interesting in this case, is not reference to the article in the Constitution, which is Article 29 on the family and the dominant role of the family in Italian culture. They describe rights of the family as a natural society founded on marriage. No, the court referred to Article 2, which is a wonderful article, rights of the person, both as an individual and in the social groups where human personality is expressed. And in line with the previous judgment on same-sex couples, the court felt that the notion of family was not its own role. It should be the legislator to intervene on redefinition of family as it is in Article 29, but same-sex couples or the couple where one of the partners decided to change sex, they come under Article 2, under the social spheres which are protected by the Constitution and the expression of individual personalities there. So Article 2 is really a multifaceted article, fascinating, because it offers a very comfortable frame for the most different cases. Perhaps it's one of the most remarkable signs of how solidarity takes shape in concrete terms within what we call intermediate bodies. Associations, NGOs, any other group that one can think of. It is a different acceptance of the Catholic traditional notion of solidarity. It's a much wider notion, and it's very useful in solving all sorts of controversies. Article 2 is very often quoted in cases of the court. For example, it's recalled in a remarkable decision in 2017, which deals with gender identity, and the court ruled that prior modifications of a person's primary sexual characteristics in order for the person to amend the gender attribution on his or her birth certificate, which is a process that you have to go through the office in question and ask for this amendment. This should not be required, the change of primary sexual characteristic, since this is an intimate choice of the individual and should be accompanied by therapeutic and psychological guidance. The individual is free to decide, and it shouldn't be the office in charge of the modification of the certificate to evaluate whether the operation was necessary or not. I think this is an interesting decision, and again, it's Article 2 giving the ground to the court to describe human personality and the way the individual expresses himself or herself in the society, in the different configurations of the societies. I mentioned intermediary bodies. Well, trade unions are also very important in the Italian tradition. There is no legislation on trade unions, although freedom of association is in the Constitution, and there should have been a law enacting a special procedure for registered unions, but never happened. So there is a risk of marginalizing trade unions, but the court rediscovered recently Article 39, Section 1, on freedom of association, and actually grounded a decision, which again I was very happy to draft, on the blocking of collective bargaining in the public sector as a consequence of austerity measures. And the court said, well, for a temporary provision it's okay, but it can go on, it can't go on for a long time or forever. So you have to re-establish bargaining because there is freedom of association, Article 39. Section 1. So really, I mean, just through these few cases that I've mentioned, I think the 70 years old Constitution does not look her age. I think she makes her voice heard through the Constitutional Court on ethical issues. For example, there's been a series of cases on medically assisted procreation, which permitted access to such a method only in cases, this was the previous one, of certified and incurable sterility or infertility of a couple. But the court ruled unconstitutional on grounds of unreasonableness, and this is the recurring technique that the court used, provisions which prohibited fertile couples from acceding to this method because they were carriers of genetic diseases from which could have been transmitted to their children. So here, the interesting point in this decision was that the court underlined the protection of a woman's health, because a woman finding herself in the position of maybe having a therapeutic abortion in cases of genetic diseases of the child should be sort of put in the position not to make that choice, but have access to the methodology that I described before. And then another example, which has been highly controversial, to show how wide the range is for the court to intervene on changing issues, is on electoral laws. This is highly controversial because the court pointed to re-establishing a balance between free individual choices and guaranteeing the equality of the vote. They were too difficult, too complicated to go into the details, but there was a way of avoiding a free choice. The court found that the individual was not free to express its electoral vote in this particular electoral law. And so the court struck down provisions which compromise representatives of the elected body, reducing drastically, in that case, the options of the voters through strict requirements, overly strict requirements. And the interesting thing is that when this ruling was drafted, the court agreed that it should be made clear that it didn't have an impact on the parliament, which had been elected through that law. So it was only for the future, this decision would have a temporal impact on the future. Again, this is an interesting technique that the court is using. I don't want to steal too much of your time, but there has been a very important decision now postponing to September the decision of the court on assisted suicide, waiting for parliament to do something. And if the parliament won't do that, then the court will intervene. And we have already a date fixed for this. So, really, you can see how the court is playing this difficult role. I mean, there's a very subtle line between politics and jurisdiction, and the court should never step over that line and interfere with parliament. But then sometimes there is an impulse that must be given to parliament. Whether it's followed or not, we'll see. This is a new technique, the one I mentioned on assisted suicide. Certainly there is this notion of irrational laws which should be struck down, because irrational laws often come together in the argument of the court with the principle of equality. It's irrational if you are not pursuing equality, or it may be unreasonable. But sometimes the court says it is reasonable to introduce some differences. So these are theories which come together in a rather complex way. But certainly, I think that these are all ways of showing how the court really opens up to society and therefore intervenes on the Constitution through the interpretation of rights and principles. For example, there's been a very interesting case law of the court granting to third country nationals, some of them even with no working permit, access to essential health care and other welfare state provisions. I sent a little paper to Felicity because it might be of interest to you to look at this case. I don't know for how long this case law will continue, but those were cases of severe disabilities, people who needed immediate and essential treatment, and they were offered this treatment. The court said, that's how it should be. These are fundamental people, rights of the person. Of course, I wouldn't be credible if I, with all the enthusiasm that I hope I'm transmitting to you, I didn't show some signs of criticism. which ran through many events in Italy in the last few years, but possibly not only in Italy, in the rest of the world. So certainly there is a lack of trust in the institution. People are skeptical, people don't believe in institutions. So very often the court is attacked for not doing the right job. For example, should the court take care of the poor? There was a case on pensions again, and some criticism was, well, you are giving again some money to the pensioners. They were very low pensions, so they had to be sort of re-established at the minimum. But why don't you do that? You give that money to poor. But the court cannot do that. The court cannot redistribute resources. So there is always a very difficult balance to make. And but what can I tell you? I'm wearing the lenses. I try to wear the lenses of objectivity and discretion. So whenever I have worries, and I do have many worries, I keep them for myself, and I wake up in the middle of the night. But I am lucky because I'm really sharing these worries with a fantastic group of colleagues. So what I've tried to do is try to share with you some of my worries and my preoccupations, but also, I hope, my enthusiasm and my respect for the 70-year-old lady.